Revolution Radio on freedomslips.com and simulcast with wolfspiritradio.com. Join JP, your tour guide today, on this journey of discovery from the known to the unknown in search of enlightenment, knowledge, and truth. Good evening, welcome, good afternoon, welcome, good morning, welcome, wherever you are on this spinning blue-green globe spinning through the solar system, tagging along behind the sun, spiraling behind the sun. If you haven't learned that, read Nassim Haramin or watch him. Good afternoon. We are today going to speak to a friend of mine from our local area. Hussein is he's the owner of the local restaurant, local Indian restaurant, and aside from that, he's quite an adventurer. He's been to Africa and to Eastern Europe in the last year or so. And today we're going to be talking about Bosnia and his experience in Bosnia, particularly with the pyramids. The Pyramid of the Sun, the Pyramid of the Moon in Bosnia that has been recently discovered to be bigger pyramids than the Giza Pyramid or anything that we find elsewhere in the world. I've already spoken with Robert Rajnak a few weeks ago about the one angle of that. So without any further ado, I'd like to welcome Hussein. Good afternoon. How are you?
Afternoon, Jeremy. Thanks for bringing on the show.
That's very good. So you're actually only about 6 miles from where I'm sitting at the moment, which makes a great change. I'm normally talking to people halfway around the world. It's actually, I really enjoy having my local contacts and friends talking on the radio. We have a great number of wise people. And in fact, you and I, last year, we organized a series of meetings in your restaurant, a kind of embryonic truther group here, and we'll probably pick that up sometime next year and see how many people are left after the end of the world. Quote.
Absolutely.
So, do you want to tell the audience a little bit about yourself and what kind of inspired you to take your travels?
Well, not sure about how the reader knows about yourself and Forest, but Forest is a small town, and I pretty much grew up here. I was born in Bangladesh, but I've been raised in Forest pretty much most of my life. And being in Forest, I've been kind of an outsider, because I was the only Asian person pretty much in my town, in my year. My family is pretty much the only Asian family. So it was a bit of isolation when we were growing up, as well as an experience in itself, because we had both worlds, one from my Bengali background and one being raised in this Western background. And being raised in forests, it was a new experience for all the local people as well, because primarily they were all white Christian people. So for me to come along, it was an experience for both sides. And I was a bit in the middle, because I grew up with both cultures,
and so I can relate to that, because I was born and raised in London, and I had a Jewish background, and there's this strange disconnect between where you are and what your culture is.
Yeah.
Obviously you made friends. You're a friendly guy. You weren't sort of picked on and stuff like that so much at school, were you?
Well, actually, that's incorrect, because when we were growing up, we were very isolated by certain groups and individuals in town, which was quite uncomfortable for my family, because we felt even more isolated and lonely because we were being targeted because of our background. But growing up, yeah, I did make a lot of friends, and that made all the difference, because the people that had a problem because of my color of skin and my ethnic background, they eventually left. while the rest of the population came to understand and know me. So they were becoming quite intrigued and curious about my lifestyle and my background and my culture and my heritage and so on. So they became more curious in a positive manner. And the people that I grew up with, they got to know me a bit better and realized I was just a human being like them at the end of the day. You know, sleep, breathe, just like them.
Yep, in a skin suit that just happens to be a different color. It's like driving a red car instead of a green car. And I have to say to everybody, your family's restaurant is the best. Beyond Forest, beyond where we live, and in the local area, spreading towards Inverness and Elgin, the best Indian food. It's fantastic, and we all love it. I wouldn't recommend it. So, a bit plugged there for anyone coming to Findhorn or Northern Scotland. Come and see. It's a cardamom seed, isn't it?
Cardamom spice.
Cardamom spice. I always get that wrong. So anyway, meanwhile, Hussein, you grew up, and so you're now early 30s, aren't you?
I'm mid-20s.
Mid-20s, right. Oh, bless your heart.
A couple of years left to go.
Yeah. So, You've done some adventuring, really. I've seen you sort of posting from Africa and from Eastern Europe. Tell us a bit about your journeys there.
Well, the biggest journey for me was actually going to Nepal, and that was back in 2010. Because what happened was I grew up with a strict upbringing in terms of religious beliefs, which kind of hindered my spiritual progression. I mean, I am from a Muslim background, but I am no longer a Muslim in the sense that I'm religious. I kind of separated from that religious dogma when I was just after university, because I met all these people there from all different faiths and backgrounds, and that further reinforced my notion that we're all human beings. We're all, as you say, beings just in spacesuits with different colors. And what happened was, some tragedy befell my family after 2009, and things became really stressful, and I wanted to make a big change in my life and take control of my life, take responsibility. So I decided to actually take on a charity program that was called the Nepal Trust, which was originally founded in the Findhorn area. So I pursued that further and went to Nepal with my best friend.
Did you really?
Yeah.
I have to say, I did some work for the Nepal Trust for about 5 years ago, 6 or 7 years ago. So we have a connection there as well in the Nepal Trust. There's a lovely, lovely couple. Anyway, go ahead.
So when I went to Nepal, it just felt uncanny in the sense I'd been there before. Like, there was a mixture of both the countryside of Bangladesh and the culture of Bangladesh, but the hillside kind of reminded me of Scotland. So it felt like a central point for me. Like, I'd been there before, and rather than just going to a new place, I was coming back to a place I'd been to. Being exposed to sunlight as well. Whenever I'm in sunlight, I just feel amazing. I'm sure most people in the world relate to that, but being born under a hot sun from Bangladesh, you know, I'm always wanting to go back. Ironically, I'm living in Scotland, so it's not the best place when you're a sun worshipper.
The place where the sun doesn't shine.
Not today, unfortunately. So when I went to Nepal, I had some amazing spiritual experiences. And one of them that I remember quite fondly was I went to the sanctuary for this philosopher. I can't remember his name. But this place was where they buried him, and he was kind of a Hindu Buddhist philosopher, kind of a guru type. And I was coming up to this round hut, and my feet were, I wasn't wearing any sandals, I was barefooted. And I started walking, and I just got this electric shock from both my soles and my feet, and I couldn't move. I wasn't paralyzed, but I just felt this energy force electrocuting my feet and shooting up to the rest of my body slowly. It wasn't an instant lightning strike. It was a slow progression. And I just felt as though I couldn't move in that instant. And I just felt myself getting charged up. And after a few seconds, the energy dissipated, it released, and I started walking, staggered in a bit, but started walking towards this hut. And when I went up to the hut, I looked inside and tried to open the door, but the door was unfortunately locked. So I peered in, and it's an empty room, I think it was for meditation purposes. I looked in, and I saw a statue of one of the Hindu gods. And something inside me said to me, look further. So, and I didn't understand what it meant at the time, but I understand it now quite clearly. What happened was, when I looked further, when I looked at the statue, there seemed to be a reflection in the window of myself. I understand that to be a message saying to me that you are the divine, that you are the spiritual being that you've been seeking for your entire life.
Yes.
So that was the message being sent to me at that time. Nepal was an amazing experience. I met some fantastic people and I had a great time, but unfortunately I had to cut my time short from Nepal Trust as things weren't going as smoothly as I hoped. But I had an amazing time and I came back to UK. And what happened was, the first few days after coming back to UK, I booked a session with Nikki Reinhardt.
My girlfriend.
Yeah. Oh, okay. All right, okay. I didn't know you two were going out. She mentioned, actually, there was someone in her life.
Yeah. Anyway, so you had a session with Nikki, who's a crystal healer.
Yes. I think she clarified that. She's a crystal healer. So I remember that one, specifically that time, because it was a life-changing experience. And what happened was, I'd seen Nikki a couple months before for crystal healing sessions, and they were wonderful, very peaceful sessions, and she's an amazing being herself, so down to earth, so lovely and so humane and loving as well, as you would know, Jeremy, being a girlfriend. So what happened was, during the experience, I was in this amazing meditative state where I was conscious, but of somewhere between conscious and unconscious. I was completely relaxed. And then something happened. This noise apparently came from nowhere. This buzzing noise. It kind of felt like, I don't know how to describe it, it was like a lawnmower kind of noise, but it was more rapid and it was much more strong, more electrical. And I could hear all sounds from outside the building, such as the birds, the children, the cars. They all became stronger, more intense, but they all combined into one noise, this one electrical humming noise. And that kind of freaked me out, but at the same time, it was, I didn't react. I wasn't scared. I wasn't scared in terms of fear. There was no fear. It was just curiosity in a sense. Scared curiosity. Straight after that, what happened was, there was a bright light that engulfed me. And I remember it coming from my toes and covering from my toes upwards to the rest of my body. And I thought, wow, this is getting really intense here. The noise and the light, what the hell is going on? Because I was thinking, Nikki must have a field day. What the hell is she doing to me? You know, I was thinking, bloody hell, this is one hell of a session.
She's using some device on you.
Yeah. And then what happened next was, I lost control of my body. My right arm started to race into the air slowly. And when that happened, I got completely freaked out. I was like, what the hell is going on? And I'm shouting at Nikki, saying, Nikki, can you not see this? What's going on? What are you doing? This and that. And I got no response from Nikki. And that's when I got no response from Nikki, I was thinking to myself, what the hell is happening? And I got kind of scared at that moment. I think what was happening was some sort of communication. And whatever was communicating with me at the time recognized that I was afraid. And when I recognized that fear, it altered the vibrational state that I was in, this conscious, unconscious state. It changed to the point where they felt they couldn't go forward because of the fear. So my hand slowly started to recede back to the ground. The light slowly dissipated and the noise went away. And I opened my eyes and I was like, Nikki, did you just see that? She was like, what do you mean?
See what? Yeah, exactly.
And I was like, did you not see the light or did you not hear the noise? And she said, no. And I was like, well, did you not hear me screaming? At least, did you not hear me say anything? He said, no, you haven't moved for the last 2.5 hours. And that's where it hit me. It's like, 2.5 hours? Just at like 10 minutes.
So you were away, mate.
It was a strange experience. And ever since, the funny thing is, ever since that experience happened, I've always wanted to go back to that experience. Even though at the time that I was afraid, I've always been chasing after that experience and trying to go back to Nikki, trying to replicate what happened. And I've been very, very close at random moments when I'm meditating at home. And I have my own form of meditation, which is just lying down with my back against the floor and my hands at the side and my feet straight. Just 20 minutes of that, and it creates this amazing meditation feeling. And I get the noise back and the vibration in the cells. I'm very, very close to what feels like an out-of-body experience. But there's something holding me back, as though I'm forcing it. That's what I'm getting.
Wow. So this a very profound experience happens during a crystal healing, and yet it seemed to be completely disconnected from the reality that your body was laying in. So, you know, you're having an out-of-body experience and you find yourself enlightened. No. So then what happened? How did that then, did that change your life in degrees as the energy was working down into your physical body? And, you know, often, you know, you have a healing one day and it takes 3 days for that healing to kind of manifest itself in your physical. So what was the process that happened after that?
Well, that was my very first, in my conscious state, a Kundalini experience. And from then on, I realized that there was more to this spiritual experience than just reading and love and so on. That it's a reality to everyone, and everyone can access it. A couple of days after that, I kind of felt drained, as though the experience completely short-circuited me. It was drawing on too much energy that needed to happen, that was stored from the solar light from Nepal, opened up my chakra points to the point where they're open enough for me to have some sort of communication with other spirits or other beings. But a few days after, I felt very weak and got the cold, which I hardly ever do. I hardly ever get the cold. And that was the first time I got a cold in a very long time. So
yeah, well, I mean, you eat vast amounts of garlic and turmeric, surely, with the food in the restaurant, which is
true. Yeah, they,
so it's very, I mean, I have to say, not only is the food good, but it's also very it's very nourishing and healthy and good for the digestion and all sorts of stuff. It's and so you're going through with these feelings and sense of connection and disconnection, and you know, it's like taking undoing the wires and then screwing them back in a bit more firmly. Is that what the sort of feeling was?
It's our upside down, inside out experience, because my life was all about career, money, progression, status, and so on. And I always had an inkling in my life that was never really important. That would have no significance to me in terms of my own being. It didn't really matter to me. I had access to money. I drove really nice cars. I had the good life that people expect, are conditioned to have, in terms of what success is. But it never felt success to me. I was never really happy with that level of success. So going through that experience, especially at the beginning, was very scary and also very lonely, because I was this young guy. I was speaking to my friends about this experience, and most of them were trying to go through student debt and just leaving homes and trying to build a career and so on. So they weren't really focused on this lifestyle, this experience that I was going through. And my family, especially my parents, because my mom was very, she's very strict in terms of her Muslim faith, and my dad has a very business mindset. So I couldn't speak to them at all. And my brother and sisters were just wondering what the hell was going on. They were thinking, what the hell? This man's turned into hippie. He's turned into this some sort of, This he's gone to the foundation and then some hippie juice, you know?
All right, just let's explain to people. The foundation, when people refer to the foundation, we're talking about Findhorn Foundation, which is a community that is like about 5 miles from Forres. Lots of people from Forres used to, you know, were attracted initially by the community and then fell in love with the area because the community... in some way to the world represents this spiritual place, but actually the whole area of Murray is a very spiritual spiritual little island in the top of Scotland. But do go on. So people thought you were turning into a hippie and you were talking all this sort of what we now call esoteric, you know, about the world is exoteric, you know, business, success and all that. But the esoteric world is from the inside, and something was changing inside of Hussein.
Was big time. No, and it wasn't a great experience in terms of, it wasn't a pleasant experience to begin with, in terms of what people were perceiving of me and the hardship that some of them were giving me. And I did feel a lot of love from a lot of them, you know? It was a lot of understanding and a lot of empathy for me and a lot of uplifting people trying to push me forward, saying, Luke, saying, just do what you need to do, what you feel is right for you. But at the same time, it was very strange for people to see me the way I was becoming, because I was this very strict Muslim person that played by the rules all the time and did things, everything by the book. But I always had this feeling in life that nothing was really right, that there was something very wrong. And the big pinnacle point for me was David Icke, I think. It was absolute David Icke. And when I first saw David Icke, I absolutely thought he was a nutter. I was seeing my friend tell me about this David Icke guy who's saying stuff, you're really corresponding to what you're going through, saying, and he's talking about this and that, and I thought, this guy's like a loony guy, I don't want to get involved. But then I started reading his stuff, and I was watching his YouTube videos, and I thought, this guy's got it spot on. This guy is very close to a lot of things and answering a lot of questions that I've been asking for most of my life.
Yes.
And the experience that he was going through as well, it corresponded to a lot of what I was going through. And it was great that someone else had gone through it. But the only difficulty that I found was my age at the time. I know it's a lot of, spirituality comes at different ages. It can come as soon as you're born. It can come on, not in terms of spirituality, the spiritual awakening is what I mean.
Yeah, the wake up moment. And normally, I mean, in the esoteric teachings that I've come across, that I've been learning, it's about the age of 35 that your soul energy starts to pour through. Except for some people who, you know, it's all about how you know, it's like your spirit is driving this thing. And it's a kind of default setting that humans get this kind of impetus. But if you've got a job to do, if you've got certain responsibilities, for instance, you may have been a teacher of a bunch of students, you need to be awake. And you know, we need to get to where we need to get to meet all our students and that sort of thing, and we need to have these experiences which will wake us up. And some of them are not the most pleasant experience indeed. I mean, for instance, mine was I had to hit a car at 60 miles an hour and burst like a paper bag in order to wake up. Yeah. You probably had slightly less of a trauma doing it, but it was still, in any way that happens, a spiritual awakening is normally traumatic. It has to be, because you've got to kind of crack the ego open, and it has to, you have to get to a point of a certain vulnerability, because that's the vulnerability that allows your soul to come in.
It's the vulnerability in itself kickstarts your awakening, in the sense that you realize there's nothing to fear. You allow and you give yourself an opportunity to let that fear go in your life.
Yeah,
you know, you're harboring all these things of what could go wrong, and very, very rarely most people will ever think what can go right or what possibilities. The possibilities are endless. The positive possibilities. They never really think about that. They've always been told or conditioned to believe. Think of, hope for the best, but expect the worst.
especially in Scotland, you know, we're used to, you know, things going wrong. And actually what I've discovered, the part of, that people are talking about the timelines, you know, there's these bad timelines and the good timeline. And the bad timeline is like everything goes wrong, everything goes to pot. And the good side is things go right. And it's like, well, this is almost too good to be true. But if you find yourself in this place of things starting to go right for you, be thankful, be incredibly grateful. I mean, I'm not talking to you generally, Hussein, here, but to our listeners as well, is that if things do start going right, don't let the doubt creep in, because that will bring you back onto the timeline that where things go wrong again. And you want to kind of keep doing things that will go right, and keep imaging futures for yourself that where everything is right. And that's what they're talking about, you know, positive thinking and positive manifestation and things like that. So Hussein, so you got to this kind of awakening, and then you thought, right, well, I've got to travel somewhere. I've got to go find someone somewhere, or something. What was your next step?
Well, what happened was, I had some difficulty with a woman at the time, as a young girl, and it was a kickstart in my life. And I had this great friend that was pushing me forward and encouraged me to see the world the way I want to see it, be the change that I want it to be. And one of the biggest changes was to look for people who had similar views, such as yourself, Jeremy, you know, in the local area. Because I met a lot of people in the foundation, and a lot of them are very happy and loving people. But they weren't willing to actually confront the issues that change literally the minds of people for the better. You know, they were so focused on just be happy and you'll be happy and everything will be okay, rather than actually confronting the issues that are really wrong with the world and confronting our ignorance, in a sense. So I searched for other people. First, I found a group called Truth Juice. I'm not sure if you heard of them.
Yes. Now, was it you who introduced? No, it was somebody from. There's a fellow called Suk who's from the Birmingham area. Do you know him?
Yes. I know Suk. I met Suk.
Yeah. So I had him on my show sometime last year, actually. Suk from Truth Juice, and he was telling me some good stuff. So there's the Truth Juice group, did you go to Wales or something to meet them?
Yes, actually, I met Suk last year as well in Truth Juice in Wales. Funny you mentioned him. Small world, isn't it?
It is a very small world, especially, you know, and sadly, it's a small world, because, you know, you start coming across the same names in various groups, and you see, you know, that... Although there's lots of groups, a lot of the groups kind of have this crossover where they're, you know, several members of the same person. So you met Sue, you went to Truth Juice
and it was my first real experience of camping and actually traveling for spiritual purposes. You know, I was always doing things in terms of family traveling wise. So I never really did things in terms of my interests. So this was my first journey in terms of my interest to explore things first and go out and see what's available in the world. So it was the first journey, other than Nepal, you know, the first journey in the UK. So that was an experience itself. But I met all these people from all ages, younger than me, from the youngest 17 all the way up to 70s and 80s. And they were having the most intense conversations in the open. And that felt so liberating, to have these conversations with people, open-minded, feel as though that you're being judged or dismissed in any way and ignored. And having these conversations that really mattered to yourself, to your friends, families, and to each other, that made the difference. And these people wanted to make a difference. It wasn't just conversations anymore. It was, what can we do to make a change? How can we contribute? So one of the biggest themes and one of the biggest attractions for me of the Truth Juice was a presentation on Bosnian pyramids. And that was my first taste of Bosnian pyramids. Before Truth Juice, I had no idea whatsoever. And I remember waking up thinking, like, I had trouble waking up early in the morning. So I'm not a morning person. Like, I'm sure you can relate, Jeremy.
Well, you know. But the thing is, you're not, because you run a restaurant, and the restaurant is open in the evenings, and so your working day starts several hours later. I mean,
it's similar to mine. I'm awake in the night because I like the peace of it in the mind, so I can do my computer programming and things. But you know, you're working late, and so you're starting late and ending late, and so you've got some free time in the night when it's quiet, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right. But you know what? I love waking up in the mornings. I love being in the sunshine and seeing the sunrise and hearing the birds wake up. Annoyingly, I'm getting woken up by my little brother in the morning who just wants to go back to bed and not go to school. But hey, can't have everything, can you? Jeremy, as back to the point of Boston Pyramids, when I went to the presentation, I was expecting this professional, but what it was this young guy. He was quite close to my age. And he was discussing presenting the Bosnian Pyramids in terms of his experience as a volunteer. And first of all, I was blown away by the concept of Bosnian Pyramids, thinking of, all right, how am I hearing this in this festival? Why am I not hearing it in mainstream news on BBC and ITV and all that, Discovery of Bosnian Pyramids? I would have thought it would have been all over the place, or at least in school. You know, it would have been a big thing archaeological-wise, that these things were discovered, but there's nothing mentioned. It's complete silence.
Nothing at all. And it's very interesting that the Egyptian, it's like almost like they've got a monopoly in the world of pyramids, whereas now we're discovering.
Add on to that. I mean, I found out a lot of interesting things in terms of conspiracy or silence around the Boston Pyramids, but we'll talk about that later on. Back to when I first discovered the pyramids. So I was listening to this presentation, and I was intrigued more. And after the presentation, we discussed heavily with other people there. I was talking a lot more to the presenter and things, like, how can I get involved in this? You know, if you got involved, it's possible for me to get involved. And he told me, yeah, man, just check out the website, apply there, and if you get a place, and head on. So as soon as I got back home, I mean, I had a wonderful time at Truth Juice, but my focus was on the Bosnian Pyramids. I just had this amazing focus on that task, just to be there. I had this feeling that I have to be there. That's my next journey. So I got home, I applied to the website, and I applied 2 or 3 times. You know, I tried phoning them in Bosnia, I faxed them, I emailed them. I just wanted to make sure that they knew my name and that they knew I was interested. That there was nothing, that everything, the universe was going to help me to get to my destination. Unfortunately, well, fortunately, depending on your perspective things, I didn't get there that year, 2011. So I applied again at the end of Africa. I went to Africa in December. I'd be actually in the Maasai Mara this time last year. It was one hell of an experience in Kenya. I traveled to 9 countries across Africa in 2 months, which is a great time. And I had a lot of crazy moments where quite possibly I could have died. And I thought to myself, there's one instance where I was climbing a hill actually in Namibia in the desert area. And I was climbing down and I didn't want to be late for dinner. I was climbing down myself. I climbed down myself. I really didn't want to be late for dinner, and the sun was about to set. I didn't want to miss the sunset either on the cliff edge. So I took a different route down, being naive as I am, thinking I'll be quicker. And I remember looking down thinking, when is this ever going to end? When am I going to get down? I looked over the edge at one point and I felt this stinging sensation in my back. And there was intense pain, like a knife was being jabbed into me and struck up and down.
Ow.
I thought, what the hell was that? I thought at first it might have been a snake bite or a scorpion. I shrugged it off as quick as I can, as best as I could. Next thing, I felt that pain again. Bang, 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 all in my back. And it was the most intense thing I'd ever felt. The most painful thing I'd ever felt. So I ripped off my shirt and started fighting off whatever it was that was attacking me. And I was jumping up and down, throwing my shirt left and right, because I couldn't see what was going on. I was just so much pain. And I saw it. I finally saw what it was. It was what they call a goba goba. I think it's a goba goba. It's a wasp that's about 2 inches.
A 2-inch wasp? Holy.
Yeah.
Holy, it was massive. Sting, Batman, yeah.
That was massive. It turned around, and in front of me, and stabbed me in the chest where my heart is. I still have the stab mark now.
Wow.
And then it came out, stabbed me in my hand, and stabbed me on my arm. And while it was stabbing me, I was fighting it off. My feet were stamping, and the ground beneath me collapsed. So I'm fighting for my life.
To make matters worse, blimey, touching the void.
Yeah, it actually saved my life, I think, because when the ground collapsed, I was rolling down the hill, the wasps no longer get to me. So I think that saved my life there, actually. And when I got when I found the strength to stand up, my legs were so weak that I could barely walk. And it came to the point there where I thought, right, this could be the end. This could possibly be my last 10 minutes. So I gave myself a 15-minute timetable of that, saying, just keep walking down the hill, keep your mind focused on getting to dinner. That's all I was worried about at the time, was getting to dinner and see the sunset, you know? And I thought, if I get 15 minutes, after 15 minutes, I'll be okay. If I'm not 15 minutes, then I'll get all the answers in the afterlife, I guess, you know? So, I'm telling you, this was one of the most intense 15 minutes of my life, as you can imagine. There were some intense moments there, and a lot of things were going through my head. But after the 15 minutes came, and I managed to get back to the camp, and I told them what happened. You know, everyone was like, man, this is typically saying he'll be all right, there's nothing to worry about, because I've been kind of a daredevil all through Africa. I mean, I almost got decapitated while horse riding, and I touched a crocodile in the wild, which is one of the stupidest things I've ever done in my life. But
yeah.
I did it, and so they were expecting, they always expect the worst from me, and hope for the best. So it was just another day for them, pretty much, in my life.
So having survived falling down a hill, being stung by a wasp, nearly being decapitated, etc., you finally make it to Bosnia.
We're
about 20 minutes out, so we got to get to the Bosnia thing. So
what happened was, I applied when I got back home, and I applied, and I got the message a couple months later saying that yes, you've got to Bosnia, and I booked my tickets in May 25th, the day before my birthday, I remember quite clearly. I booked my tickets, and I was absolutely ecstatic. And it was for 24th of August. Ironically, 2 years before was the same day that I left Nepal. I didn't realize it, but it was exactly the same day that I left Nepal.
Dates have been very, very significant recently. We'll talk later. But, so you got this date cycle thing going on.
I did, yeah. So I got to Bosnia, and it was intense. I just got there straight away, and it hit me that you realize, wow, you're in this place, this country that's been talked about for the last 20 years in terms of warfare and savagery and so on. The amount of things that have gone there, you could see the history on the walls of the buildings. You know, there's riddled bullet holes, and some buildings were burnt out, and you could. It felt as though that you were in a third world country in some parts. But the people there were absolutely magnificent. They were so nice and so friendly. Ironically, at the same time, they pickpocketed me. But that's another story.
Well, you know, people get desperate and, you know,
So. But eventually, the following day, Sorry, 2 days after, because I was in Sarajevo for 2 days, and one of the girls that I met at Truth Juice, I was going to meet at the same destination, Bosnian Pyramids. And I remember walking down, the day after I arrived in Bosnia, in Sarajevo, I was walking down to go for lunch, and there she was. She literally bumped right into me at the same hostel that I was staying at. Talk about coincidences.
Oh, yeah. So, and she suggested?
Well, we were just going out for lunch, and we catched up. And the following day, we took a bus to Visoko, the town where the Bosnian pyramids are located. And on the bus ride there, we met quite a lot of the other people that were volunteers. And it was crazy. You know, you could just tell straight away that they were there for the volunteer program. All these people in their rucksacks, and I just introduced myself, and there's amazing all across the world, from Malaysia, a lot of them from UK, from as far as Canada, New Zealand, Brazil, just for this event. Note the amount of attraction to that the amount of people from all over the world that came just to help and see this for themselves. And for some of them, it's like, such as myself, it's like a rite of passage. You know, a lot of them describe
it. Certainly, certainly. You know, going to a, this is a, or what we call an initiation. You have to, you know, you leave everything behind, going completely into the unknown.
I remember first looking, gazing at the pyramids and thinking, how the hell could they have missed this? You know, how the hell could they not have spotted this as being an artificial structure? The day we arrived in Visoko, we went up to the pyramid and to have a look around. And I remember seeing the slabs. And there were layer upon layer upon layer, as though they were building materials, almost like massive bricks. You're building this massive house. And you look at the formation of these slabs and how similar in design they were. Like, they were not random.
Like, they were almost cast out of the same mold.
Exactly, exactly. And some spots it was really, really smooth. And the first couple of days when we were up there, it was this feeling of, wow, we're here. I'm seeing this for myself. And the following days, my job for the first week was working in tunnels. They discovered tunnels that are leading towards the pyramids. And when you go in these tunnels, you have this presence there. You feel a presence at all times. That you're never really alone.
Ooh.
Yeah, it was a great feeling, but at the same time, it's an eerie one as well. And it's so strange when you're in the tunnels and you come out, you forget you're there during the daytime, because the tunnels are so dark and they're full of artificial light. And when you actually go out and you see the blue sky, you think, "Wow, it's actually in there." You know, it's like it's the daytime, because it might be. Five or six hours
just away. So I get the feeling that there, in the tunnel, there is a dreamlike quality. Is that right?
The tunnels themselves are they're filled with water, and there's three combinations. There's the way that what Samir described it was three parts of tunnels. That there's the significance of these monoliths that we discovered that were. Some of them are 7 tons, and that they generate energy. Well, not actually generate energy, they source energy from the earth. The theory is, from Semir and some other people that are involved in the project, is that the local area generates some sort of energy and that pyramid, at first, one of the archaeologists that was there, his speculation was that there was a hill there, a natural hill, that attracted some sort of energy formation, some sort of energy type. And that the builders of the pyramid, recognized this energy source and used it for their own purposes. They originally carved out the tunnels, perhaps to direct the energy, because when you actually inspect the tunnels further, have you heard a guy called Klaus Donner?
Yes, the hidden history.
Yes. Well, Klaus Donner, he did a satellite imagery of deep penetrative satellite imagery to check out the possible tunnels. And he got it from a military friend of his. And when you look at the schematics of these tunnels that we discovered inside, it almost looks like there's roots. It's like a tree, roots spreading out across the land. So my theory is that the original builders, recognized the significance of this energy, channeled the energy using these tunnels and water, deep underground water, and directed towards the pyramid. And the material that was brought out from the tunnels was then used to create the concrete to make the slabs of the pyramid.
Very interesting, yes. So basically, the water filled or water, you know, water layered tunnel would be a channel for chi.
Yes.
Which is the same as the force, and is the same as pyramid energy and body energy, and you know it's you know life energy, globules of life energy, and so that's the so there's a kind of root system thing that draws energy up to the prime vortex in the middle, which was a natural occurring vortex that they built upon. And presumably that's on some kind of major ley line crossing or, you know, crystal grid of that and things or something like that. I remember Robert was saying some stuff like that.
Well, so, there's a natural crystal formation there as well, built into the rocks, which was kind of strange. I mean, a lot of the researchers that went there discovered that the, in some locations on the pyramid surface, that there was veins of quartz crystal being going into the rock, which was what seemed to be unnatural. They couldn't figure out how this was possible. And as we know, as you know, Jeremy, that crystal itself is a transmitter, receiver of information, of energy.
As we are, and they're living beings as well, living organisms. They're not they're silicon-based life forms, not carbon-based. So,
yes, yes. Well, another thing about these ornaments, the monoliths that they generate some sort of energy. They funnel the energy from the ground. One person, she was a highly spiritual person. She arrived the day before the conference, international conference that was being held in the Soko. She meditated on one of these monoliths, and I wasn't present at the time, but one of the chief diggers was, as well as other members of volunteer group. And she went to a deep state of meditation, and in her mind, what she described was she was seeing a blue light, a blue, violet, purple light. And out of nowhere, this blue, purple, violet light came from the ceiling and hit the ground, separated into two while she was meditating, so she wasn't aware of this happening, but others were, and they recorded this happening, actually. You can actually see this on YouTube. This light appeared, and it appeared separated and combined for about 15 to 20 minutes. It never happened before.
Wow. Okay, so what are the search terms that people can use to find that video?
I think it's on... I'll actually post it on your Facebook page, Jeremy.
Okay, and I'll put that onto the Wolf Spirit Radio Facebook page.
Sure.
Straight after that, and along with the link to the archive to this show. Very, very interesting. Right, well, we've got about 12 minutes left, 13 minutes left, so...
Another interesting point, which is, you know that they discovered an energy beam?
Yes, this blue beam that came up the top.
Yeah, they also recorded some sort of radio broadcast, and you can actually listen to this broadcast on the website. And when I was listening to this broadcast, it almost felt like there was some sort of voice. It's like a lot of static and this voice in the background.
Oh, yeah.
And when you speak to a lot of the people, the volunteers, you ask them, what brought you here? And a common theme again and again and again they say is, I felt a calling. I just felt this calling as though I was being attracted to this area. And it almost felt like this broadcast, when it was being emitted, it is like a radio broadcast, like an SOS almost, or come to me.
Absolutely. So this called your soul.
It
called all these other people. They're very likely that you're all in a soul group.
Precisely.
You're all connected in the last cycle.
I met people there. I've met so many people there that I'm in contact with now. And I spoke to an email. I gave an email to one of the friends that I met there. And the last thing, one of the things I wrote to her was, we came together as friends, but we left as family. You know, it was so emotional when we actually had to depart, because we came so close to each other, worked in a significant moment in our lives. And it almost felt as though we kind of knew each other. You know, a lot of us, it was almost like we were a family, a big, big, massive family, as we all are.
Yeah, but there are groupings, and, you know, some of the more psychic among you would have had past life memories of actually knowing each other and things like that. This is the time, 13,500 years ago, from what I can understand, there were many groups all over the world who needed to encode their work so that when the time was right, basically 13,500 years ago, the Earth went and the sun went into the northern hemisphere of the galaxy, and all of the, it's like having a left and right car, you know, all of the vehicles and everything didn't work anymore because the polarity was reversed. Now we're coming back. We're going back across the crossing. This is the time of the crossing. And the ley lines are going to become activated. They're already becoming activated. And those gatherings help to channel the activation, get the activation right. You all did the right thing, but you didn't know what you were doing, except some of you did. Is that right?
Well, some of us were there to... We all thought as though we were trying to do something amazing for the pyramid, but it came to the point where it felt as though some members were kind of claiming the pyramid for themselves. So there seemed to be some sort of grouping going on in terms of there's us and then there's them. There's a volunteer foundation and then there's the foundation to discover the pyramid. Because there seemed to be some sort of almost felt like a coup going on between some of the volunteers, that they wanted more rights in terms of... I mean, a lot of what they wanted was actually very understandable. Because one thing that this whole project needs is more awareness. And it needs people from universities to come in, and professional archaeologists, professional demolition experts, people that building experts and so on. It needs people with great expertise to come in and progress this project further. There's a conspiracy of silence. A lot of people that came there were law school students. And some of them I asked, what would you tell your fellow colleagues back home and your professors and so on? And they were like, no, I won't tell them a thing. I won't tell them that I've been here. And I was like, why not? This is probably one of the biggest things that's going to happen to you in your entire life. This could be your make or break for your career. And he goes, no. There's so much fear in terms of the Bosnian pyramids that students don't mention it to their professors because they're instantly ridiculed. They're instantly dismissed.
That is an amazing fact, Hussein. Thank you for sharing that with everybody, because people have this opinion, this feeling, you know, it's just a meme. It's, you know, it's the idea that archaeologists are, they're all, what's his name? Harrison Ford. Indiana Jones, yeah, the archaeologists are all like Indiana Jones, they're all over-curious, they get themselves into trouble. Actually, a lot of them are really bureaucratic, and they absolutely follow the party line, and the party line is that history began 6,000 years ago, smirk, and that the only pyramids in the world are Egyptian, and it was all built by the same Egyptians who are still in this town today, etc., which is obviously baloney.
What's so amazing about this project is it combines so many principles. It combines the professional and scientific body, as well as the esoteric and spiritual part. You know, it's not just about, right, they built this for sacrifice, or they built this for to make it look nice, the scenery and all that. They built this for a very specific purpose. They themselves say that this structure is some type of machine, and they're looking at all avenues, all possibilities. So they invite everyone from all walks of life to come here, to come to that destination, and to give their feedback, their experience to the project. They do not isolate to one principle, because this project belongs to everyone. Semir, I applaud him, because he's a very open man in terms of bringing this project to everyone. He doesn't want to claim this project for himself. He believes the whole thing belongs to the whole mankind. So, the concept of bringing all principles to the table is amazing, I think, in terms of this project. I mean, yeah. They don't have a dogma of, right, this is standard protocol of how archaeological is done, we have to follow this set of rules and so on. It's not done mainstream-wise, but it still respects the scientific principles that are needed to investigate further, while...
So, we've got 5 minutes, Hussein. It's been a very interesting journey with you today. And certainly it's been eye-opening in terms of, you know, busting perceptions on what people think science is all about. You know, because archaeology, it's one of the sciences. It's supposed to be relatively precise due to carbon dating, which is part of physics. And then physics at this moment discovers that there are solar emissions that cause carbon to decay at different rates. And so we can't really trust carbon dating anymore. We have to work off other clues, you know, the styles and other things we know happened in the past. But to kind of sum it up, you've been to these places, and, you know, you've had trouble. Take it back to Hussein. What has Hussein gained in these times? What has your journey been? But very briefly, are there any nuggets you can? That's the end of the show. Very quickly, have you got a website?
Myself?
Yeah.
No, it's just a Facebook page.
Okay, Hussein Ahmed, come through my page, people. Bless your heart. Thank you very much, Hussein. It's been a very interesting chat.
It's been a pleasure, Jeremy. Thanks for inviting me.